Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting what you say. Today is the day.
Welcome to Faith Radio Mornings, and good morning, everyone, here for the 16th of January. This is our show, part of the Faith Radio Network, that broadcasts live every morning, in which we talk about so many of the news headlines of the day, some of the different topics that interest us as believers, whether we're in a younger generation, older generation, families, grandparents, anything along those lines. We try to bring to you each morning here on Faith Radio Mornings, doing so from a distinctly Christian perspective, talking about these headlines from the place of hope as we fix our eyes on Jesus together. It's always a very busy show on these days. Guests from all around the country and sometimes even all around the world begin to join us. I know we have Drew Griffin up in just a second, as he's going to be joining us from Israel. I'm your host for the show, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and Rachel Sutton and Paul Perot are doing their usual great work keeping everything flowing smoothly, as well as filling us with some of the headlines of the day that would be relevant for our guests. And I just referenced Drew, and he joins us regularly from Providence Magazine. It's a great site that you can go to talk about the intersection of Christianity and foreign affairs from an American standpoint. And Drew travels regularly. I never really know for sure where he is in the world, but it sure sounds like he's in Israel this morning. Good morning, Drew.
Hey, good morning, Peter. How are you? Shalom from Israel.
Shalom. I love it. So what part of Israel are you in? Are you in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv? Are you in the north in Galilee? Where are you located right now, Drew?
I'm in Tel Aviv right now.
So some events over there, obviously, it's a different world, and I don't know how you experience Israel. It sounds like you've been there a few different times, but there's something about just being in the thick of it there. There's something about the land. There's something about the history, kind of the ancient feel of the place. It really is different when you step off the plane, isn't it?
It is, yeah. There's something truly unique about spending time in Israel. It's a unique land. It's been the focal point of world events and world focus for centuries, and you feel the weight of that attention. You feel the weight of the historic significance almost from the moment that you get off the plane. And, of course, for Christians, it is the site of our the beginning of our faith and the life of our Lord and the beginning of our church. And so it's the history is palpable and the significance is overwhelming. This almost from the moment you get on the plane, and it never really gets old, no matter how many times you come here.
Yeah, it's interesting how much the Bible really does come to life. I know I'm sure people hear people say that travel to Israel and could maybe be skeptical about it, but it's such an interesting phenomenon to be there. And somehow the Bible just makes all so much more sense when you actually see the geography of the land.
Yeah, it's really the geography, the physicality of it. It takes the story that you read in the Bible and that you're raised on, you know, growing up, stories that seem like they, you know, almost could be myths, or maybe they didn't really happen. But then when you actually go to the cities and the towns and the hills and the valleys where these incidents occurred, it really brings scripture to life and makes it concrete in a way that really nothing else can.
It's Drew Griffin, one of the editors of ProvidenceMag.com. It's a great website to go to if you're listening this morning, where you can look at quite a bit of American foreign policy through the lens of Christianity. Drew joins us regularly and does a great job covering so many of these headlines. And when we come back in just a moment, Drew, would love to get your perspective on Brexit and the no confidence vote that's coming up here today in the United Kingdom, as the vote failed miserably yesterday. And we also need to talk about a very difficult situation out of Kenya with a terrorist attack that just happened. So more to come with Drew Griffin next here on Faith Radio Mornings. just about 10 minutes past the hour here on the 16th of January for Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host for the show, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and you've already heard the voice of Drew Griffin, who works for Providence Magazine. It's providencemag.com. Great website to go to catch so many of the headlines around the world from a Christian perspective. And Drew, we saw some pretty interesting events coming out of the United Kingdom yesterday. It wasn't unanticipated, but perhaps the votes and the disparity in the votes, yes versus no, in terms of Theresa May's proposal to leave the European Union was a pretty widespread. Here, we got a quick clip from that last night.
The ayes to the right, 202. The noes to the left, 432. So the noes have it. The noes have it.
I mean, first of all, Drew, I think we can just refer to the idea that it'd be really nice to have that kind of accent when everything just sounds so credible if we could speak in that kind of way.
Yeah, it's a funny concept that as soon as you have a British accent, it either makes you the evil villain in a movie or it makes you kind of the authoritative character. I don't know why we associate it with that.
But it was quite a difference in the votes then yesterday, too, when you saw that there was about 230 votes spread. Some of the MPs there in Britain voting against Theresa May's plan. And, boy, that really leaves what's going to happen in the United Kingdom in terms of Brexit and leaving the European Union. It leaves it really uncertain. There's a lot of different directions it could go from here.
Yeah, I think it's important to kind of bring the listeners, you know, up to speed. In 2016 is when, you know, the Parliament, actually the general public in Great Britain voted by 51% to leave the European Union. And what happened at that moment is it really triggered a set of deadlines and a set of things in motion that couldn't be undone. And it called for the Article 50, which is an article within the European Constitution, which allows nations to leave. Once the United Kingdom adopted that Article 50 and sent that into the European Union, the exit date for Britain was set in stone, and it's March 29th here of 2019. And so what happened then is that the Parliament, led by Theresa May, had to come up with some kind of plan begin to define what the relationship will be in the future between Great Britain and the European Union. And it's really important, I think, for us to grasp, and I think the people in Great Britain are coming to a realization of this, is that it's not a single cord, you know, that ties them together with the continent and ties them together with the European Union. You simply cut that cord and kind of go off and do your own thing. It's in fact a network and a web of cords that if you have to cut all of them, and each one of those pertains to a money flow between the European Union and Great Britain's citizens, how the citizens move back and forth and immigrate back and forth between the European Union and Great Britain, the economic agreements for imports and exports out of the country, all of which are kind of imperiled. They've been currently defined ever since the United Kingdom has been a part of the European Union, but when come March 29th, all of that could just simply vanish. And so what you have is you have companies that are relying on imports, where those imports will now, instead of being free flowing from one country to another, are going to be tied up with new inspections and possible tariffs. And the economic implications for Great Britain are really what's startling. And so Theresa May puts together this massive proposal to kind of articulate how the United Kingdom can leave, how Great Britain can leave the European Union. And that's what they voted on yesterday. And by the largest votes in really modern history, the Parliament rejected her plan. So what happens now is if they cannot come up with some sort of plan like what May has developed, Great Britain will leave the European Union with really no resolution to all of those small kind of ancillary details that have tied Britain to the European Union for so many decades. So there's really great uncertainty, which is rocking the markets. in Great Britain. It's affecting their currency, and it's actually sending ripples throughout all of the other nations in the European Union.
And it's interesting when you evaluate and get inside analyzing why there is the no vote at the level that it was. And I think one of the things maybe we misunderstand in the States, Drew, is that when we see a vote against something, maybe in the House of Representatives or in the Senate, it usually is a party line vote. The Democrats don't want something, they all link together and vote against it, or vice versa with Republicans. But in this case, the no's were coming but from both sides, where some people were saying that Theresa May's proposal allowed them to stay too close to the European Union, and other people were voting against it because there was a sense in which it didn't go far enough with Brexit. So there was just a real difference in the reason why people were saying no, and that's why I think people are suggesting it's hard to see a pathway forward other than a hard Brexit at this point.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think what the one kind of glimmer of hope is that the if it looks like there could be a new referendum, which I know many people are advocating, and many of the people on the other side of the aisle, the Labour Party, are advocating that there be a new general referendum, basically. But now that they've had 3 years of kind of sussing this out in the public square, and the British people recognize the difficulty that is entailed in exiting the European Union. The idea is to give them another shot at deciding whether or not they do truly want to leave. And if it looks like that could at all be a possibility, the European Union may extend that deadline a couple of months in order to give Great Britain a little bit more time, potentially to do another general referendum. Because the great fear among the nations within the European Union, especially nations like France, especially nations like Germany and Italy, is that with a rising kind of tide of populism in all of those countries, that an exit of Great Britain could signal, you know, to those populists within these other countries that the European Union is weak, and that it could be dismantled. And I think that there is that fear that this very delicate and imperfect but admirable institution of the European Union that has kept Europe in the greatest period of peace in its combined history could potentially be dismantled.
Well, and we see some of that in some of the strongest countries within the European Union historically, and that being Britain and Germany and France. And all three of them are fending off some pretty significant populist movements right now, obviously with Britain leaving. But Merkel in Germany has seen her leadership really begin to falter. And of course, Macron, the president of France, is dealing with approval rates that hover around 20% and protests every weekend all throughout France. So this is not an alarmist thing to suggest that this could be the beginning of the end for the European Union.
Well, I think it's important to emphasize that this is one of the reasons why the representative democracy is often preferable to direct democracy. I mean, you see the general referendum, and it's very easy when you're trying to communicate complex ideas to millions and millions of people in a referendum to oversimplify things and to say, well, you know, we just need to leave and we need to get our country back. And there are very legitimate concerns that many of the people in Great Britain have about their culture and about immigration and about the influx of Islamic immigrants and Muslim immigrants into their country. I mean, these are valid concerns, and they don't need to be dismissed. But it's also, you know, very dangerous to oversimplify it. And I think what you see, one of the reasons why we have representative democracy, why that is so popular across the world when it comes to forms of government, is that, you know, instead of oversimplifying things, instead of trying to communicate the mass amount of decisions that are necessary with a move like this, we elect representatives who spend every moment of their day, hopefully, considering this stuff. So it goes to the type of government we have. It goes to the type of democracy that we want to rely on. And it definitely is, I think, an uncertain time for Great Britain and for Europe right now.
It's the voice of Drew Griffin, who's the managing editor for Providence Magazine. The website is providencemag.com. It's a great website. I highly recommend going there to really get some insights into some of the headlines around this world and staying within the Christian perspective in doing so. And, Drew, when we come back from break, let's change the topic over to some of the events out of Kenya that happened here just within the last 12 hours and the really difficult terror attack. I need to get your insight on that next.
some hope. You're gonna do great things. I already know God's got his hand on you, so don't live life in fear. Forgive and forget, but don't forget why you're here. Take your time and pray. These are the words I would say.
21 and a half minutes past the hour here on the 16th of January on Faith Radio Mornings. We're chatting with Drew Griffin this morning about some of the headlines from around the world. And Drew, when I woke up this morning, I saw some pretty difficult headlines coming out of Kenya. For our listeners that might just be getting up or getting off to work and getting their kids ready for school, can you give us a sense of what's happening there?
Yeah, yesterday, gunmen and bombers entered into a hotel in Nairobi, which is Kenya's capital, and threw bombs into vehicles and entered into the hotel and began shooting and killed somewhere between 14 and 24 individuals. The hotel has been secured and the militants have been removed. And the group that has claimed responsibility is the group Al-Shabaab, which is a Somali terrorist group. The Somali terrorist group Al-Shabaab has carried out a number of attacks against Kenya over the last several years. Most notably, in the last 6 years, in 2013, there was an attack on a mall in Nairobi, which killed 67 people. That was carried out by Al-Shabaab. In 2015, at Garissa University, 150 people were killed. And the reason why Al-Shabaab is focusing on Kenya and carrying out attacks in Nairobi, even though they're a Somali group, radicalist fundamentalist Islamic group in Somalia, is that Kenya is part of a peace group, keeping effort in Somalia that's helping the Somali government fight these militants. And so not only are they carrying out attacks in Somalia and across eastern Africa, they frequently target Kenya and Nairobi. And this is kind of the latest example of just their rage and horror, the terrorism that they are inflicting on the neighbor countries to Somalia.
And certainly, Drew, terrorism has been going on well before 9/11 here in the United States. But I find it interesting now that we've been living kind of with an awareness from a global perspective of it over the last 17 years. Is the aim of the terrorism, just generally speaking, is it to destabilize and create fear? I don't see a lot of situations where terrorists ultimately come into power in a country and form a government and begin to rule from that perspective. I don't always understand the end game here. So can you give us some more insight on what happens around the world as these attacks are taking place?
Well, when it comes to, terrorism can have a number of different rationales, and terrorists can have a number of different rationales, and never are those ever very rational, you know. The main goal, I think, of a great deal of Islamic terrorism is to destabilize governments that are hostile to Islam, destabilize and potentially remove governments that foster pluralism and religious freedom in order to establish a Muslim dominance, an Islamic dominance in whatever country that they are attacking, in whatever country that they are fighting. This is the case with Al-Shabaab. We saw this with ISIS when it grew out of the vacuum that was left by the United States when we exited Iraq. The Islamic State there in the Levant, ISIL, was a Muslim group that carried out terrorist attacks in order to establish an Islamic caliphate from Baghdad to Damascus and to establish an Islamic religious nation. And so they're going to fight every group that fosters pluralism, every group that fosters democracy, any group that does not acknowledge Muslim and its prophet Muhammad and Islam as the chosen religion and the preferred religion. And so, terrorists can have a number of different rationales, but this is what we typically see with large-scale groups that are carrying out attacks. It's not just to vent anger. It's not just to deteriorate governments. It's to establish Islamic rule and to put down any sense of pluralism, freedom, or democracy, or any kind of religious freedom that doesn't show preference to Islam.
And as you're in Israel right now, Drew, and we talk about terrorism, certainly there is a sense in which that's always part and parcel to people's psyche throughout the day in a place like Israel or in the Middle East. And obviously in the United States, we're talking quite a bit about a wall being built on the southern border. And I know that in Jerusalem, they did build a wall separating them from the West Bank and some other parts of maybe the Bethlehem area. And it's been a pretty effective barrier. But boy, it really hasn't resolved any of the tension, has it?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the wall did result in a great deal of safety, but it had a great deal of economic consequence, you know, for individuals in the West Bank. And it is a, it's, you know, a very complex issue. I think it would be, it's not analogous to draw a line between the wall around, you know, the West Bank or the wall in East Jerusalem, between that and the wall on the U.S. southern border. You know, the United States, one, already has a number of walls and physical structures at all of the points of entry into the United States, where 90% of the traffic comes. So there are already walls. And so I think any effort to kind of draw a similarity between the two is not really analogous, because it's a completely different situation, a completely different part of the world, and the complexities and the religious layers that are present here in Israel are just non-existent when it comes to the United States and Mexico. So, yeah, but it continues to be a very tense place. But, you know, one of the beautiful things about Israel is you know, they are committed, I believe, to peace. They're committed to freedom and enjoyment of freedom of their citizens. And so they take whatever efforts are necessary to ensure that that freedom can be enjoyed. And I've been here many times. I've always felt safe and always enjoy my time here, and always impressed by the culture that Israel is fostering here in their nation.
Yeah, certainly. And the times that I've been there, too, there's when you look from outside looking in, you can think, gosh, there just must be tension in the street all day long. But it really is a safe and prosperous and beautiful place. And as Christians, can't recommend enough to go visit to see some of these holy sites where you are now.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it should be on everyone's bucket list, if not just your kind of tourist list. And not only just to you know, for the biblical angle and the religious angle, but this is a nation that I think is an example and can be an example of what it looks like to live in a pluralistic society, what it looks like in the Middle East to have a democracy that allows for freedom of religion and freedom of the press. And it's complex and it's difficult and it can at times be tense, but that. It's a beautiful picture of what is possible here, and so I think we should do what we can to support the nation as one of our allies, as one of the great examples of pluralism and democracy here in the Middle East.
And Drew, before we let you run, I just have to ask the question. We had a doctor on our program last week that said that the best diet somebody can possibly eat is the Mediterranean diet, and it's olives and beans and all of what you see and where you are right now. Do you enjoy the Mediterranean food there?
I do. I love it. I feel like it's every time I come here, I eat far healthier than I do back in the States, and I drink a lot of water, and yeah, everything is natural and fresh, and it's delicious. I told a friend of mine that sometimes I feel like I come here, it's warm and it's sunny and the food is really good and healthy, that it's like coming to an extremely secure spa, you know, in the Middle East. But I will say, after a couple of weeks, I am hungering for a bacon sandwich, maybe some ham with breakfast, since that's something you don't get a lot here, maybe a hamburger. So I will be quite happy to go back to my diner in New York City.
That's great. It's Drew Griffin of managing editor of Providence Magazine at providencemag.com. Again, we highly suggest going there. Drew, thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule in Israel to join us here this morning on Faith Radio Mornings.
Absolutely, Peter. Thanks so much.
We'll head over to Lighten Up for a little bit fun this morning, as well as some bottom-of-the-hour news. And when we come back for the second half of this hour, I'll be joined by good friend Hugh Welchel of the Institute of Faith, Work, and Economics. And Hugh's going to give us some insight about the impact of the ongoing partial government shutdown. Well, we are, as I'm sure many of you are, continuing to follow the story of Jamie Kloss and her wonderful reemergence, and the fact that she is safe and sound, at least from a physical standpoint, at this point in time, reunited with so much of her extended family. And as some of the news begins to come out about the entire situation, just is so difficult to understand what would go into the mind of somebody, a 21-year-old man, who would do such an atrocity like this. The grandfather of Jake Patterson, the man who perpetrated this, came out yesterday and said that his grandson was quiet and shy, nice and polite, often avoided crowds. His grandfather, Jim Moyer, also said Patterson was more into computer games than social interaction, and that his family is absolutely heartbroken. And as we stand and, of course, reacting with horror of what happened, prayers and forgiveness and thoughts all the way across the board for everybody who's been deeply impacted by this situation. Justin Gibney of the AND campaign, who works so well just carving out space between the Democrats and the Republicans to do politics from a distinctly Christian perspective, spoke yesterday on our program about the selfless love Christians have displayed in the midst of racial divide and violence.
It's completely otherworldly. It's not logical, and we shouldn't expect a lot of other people to get it. But I think it is a matter of prayer. It's a matter of being as close to the cross and understanding the life of Jesus as much as possible to get to a place where you understand that the ultimate victory isn't here. The ultimate victory is beyond, and you are here, number one, not to win something, but you are here to have a witness that is worthy of, you know, of what the Father and doing the Father's business. And so at the end of the day, no, we don't just accept whatever goes down here. We try to do what we can do to make things better, to serve justice and to do justice. But we have to keep in mind that there are greater things than what's here on earth.
Justin had some really powerful thoughts yesterday about how to heal the racial divide and how we as believers need to maybe even learn how to bless those who curse and all of these things that Jesus invites us into that make no sense in this world but make all the sense of the world in a kingdom. If you want to hear all of what Justin had to say, head to our website at myfaithradio.com. It's one you're not going to want to miss. And I see that Hugh Welchel from the Institute of Faith, Work, and Economics is already on the line. And it sounds like Hugh and his team over there are nomads at this point in time. They've moved out of their old offices, but the new offices are not ready. They are people without a home. I want to get his perspective next on the partial government shutdown and some other economic details in our country.
What were the principles of our founding fathers, and why should we care? Good question. This is Jim Garlow. Were all of the 204 men who signed the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence Christians? No, but there was an overarching faith perspective that shaped the values, ideals, and principles of the men who wrote our founding documents and led our first Congress. John Adams, the author of the Declaration, wrote, "The general principles on which the fathers achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity." America was founded as a nation, rooted in higher law, not in man's law. When you encounter those who would deny any religious roots in this country, you can be confident it was well understood by our founding fathers that the inalienable rights they wrote of and spoke to were part of a higher law established by God, not by man. Be well versed in these issues at jimgarlow.com.
Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Peter Kapsner, and delighted to be joined, as always, by Hugh Welchel of the Institute of Faith, Work, and Economics, who does such a great job here with us on Faith Radio Mornings, talking about different things in our country that have a decided economic impact in our lives. Good morning, Hugh.
Good morning, Peter. It's great to be with you guys again.
So you don't have an office. You're a man without a home when it comes to work right now, Hugh. Is that what I understand?
That is sad but true. Sad but true. In fact, we're waiting on government permits to move into our new place. They're trying to get some changes made, but before we can do anything, we've got to get some permits. So, and fortunately or unfortunately, as the case may be, we're not waiting on the federal government. We're waiting on the local government. But sometimes it seems like they're shut down as well. They don't move very quickly.
Well, we're certainly in uncharted territory on some levels in our country. This is the longest government shutdown, even though it's a partial one. It's the longest government shutdown we've ever had. So we don't really for sure know how this is all going to impact us. But Hugh, one of the impacts that I've seen, it seems to be within airports right now, that security lines and TSA, there's a long wait, if not just a cancellation altogether.
Well, I've heard varying things. I've heard that some places there's long waits. Other places, I've heard there aren't any waits. So it's really kind of hard to tell. I guess it's kind of a place by place. Of course, you know, I think back the last time I traveled I've traveled quite often, but 4 or 5 months ago when I was traveling, I had long waits and there wasn't a government shutdown. So I think part of that is just the inefficiency that government has in getting their things done, because the government has gotten so large and it is, you know, it's just way bigger
than it probably was ever designed to be. Certainly much bigger than the founding fathers had ever possibly imagined.
And when the government is the size that it is, Hugh, it does mean that a lot of people are drawing their income from that. And, of course, last Friday was the first Friday that passed in which people didn't receive their paychecks if they've been affected by this partial government shutdown. And losing one paycheck is certainly a big blow to many people living check to check. Are we seeing some of the rippling implications of that now, even a few days later?
Yeah, I think we are. And let me say, I feel terrible for people who have been laid off and are not getting paychecks. I even feel worse for those who have to keep working. The TSA people are a perfect example. They have to keep working and don't get a paycheck. Now, fortunately or unfortunately, as the case may be, it doesn't help them right now. But for most of these workers, it's a temporary problem, right? It's a cash flow issue. And in the history of all the shutdowns that's ever taken place, I'm certainly sure it will be this one as well. Everyone has always been repaid what they would have made. Even those that aren't working are still repaid what they would have been paid if they were working. So for most of these people, it's a temporary shutdown, and it's a temporary hardship. But, of course, if you're living paycheck to paycheck and you have to go borrow money to make your house payment or borrow money to buy food, it's a true hardship. So I do feel my heart goes out to those people. I think the hidden piece that we don't see is the ripple effect that the government shutdown has. There are, for every government employee that's being impacted, there are probably 10 to 20 additional people that are in the economy whose job really revolves around doing things for the government. These would be government contractors. These would be people like, well, for example, before I started the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics, I ran a large training organization where we did computer training, and the government was one of our largest clients. And I can think of those guys right now, you know, those workers aren't coming to be trained. So that is revenue that company's losing. Now, interesting enough, they don't get paid back. That will be permanent revenue loss. Restaurants, you can go on and on. There's this, you know, there's this huge impact that's happening to the economy. I saw one estimate by an economist, and actually it's one of the government economists. I guess he's still working. But he suggested that for every week the shutdown goes on, it pushes down the growth, the GDP growth of the United States, 0.1%. So if we're shooting for 2.5% growth, between 2 and 2.5%, which is what they're hoping for this next quarter, if this thing goes on for a long time, it would have such an effect on the economy that we reduce the overall growth and may drop it under 2% even. Now, once again, that's kind of speculation, but you can kind of understand that when you see the larger ripple effect that this has on the bigger economy.
But I think, Hugh, that's the part that I know for somebody like you that deals in economics week in and week out, maybe lost on people like me that isn't necessarily in that field all the time, but that there really is a systemic effect. That the headlines, obviously, there is a compassion for the people who are losing their paychecks and justifiably so, but it really is the impact as well that happens in our economy, because this has to, we're a consumption-based economy, and if people don't have money to consume, then it starts to have a pretty big impact moving forward.
That's right. It's a short-term problem for the people in the government because they will eventually get paid. They will eventually get their pay, their back pay they'll get. But for these other people that are all these supportive industries, that's just money they'll lose. They'll never get that money back. So it's a huge impact. But I tell you, the whole shutdown, I think, is an interesting. It kind of helps us kind of rethink what's the purpose of government. I mean, I read one kind of commentator that was writing. He said, you know, think about this. These are 800,000 people have been laid off, and they say that they're basically I'm trying to think of the word they call them, but not unimportant workers, but they're not critical workers, right? They're not critical positions. And he said, so if these people aren't critical for running the government, why are they there anyway, right? And he went on to suggest that maybe this is a time we should seriously look at cutting down the government workforce. Now, the interesting thing we've had for probably 35 years, as far back as I can remember anyway, we've had promises and promises by politicians who got elected that they were going to reduce the size of the government. The government size has never been reduced that I can remember. It continues to grow. Even Ronald Reagan, the great conservative, he continued to grow the government. It grew under every president of the last seven or eight presidents. And you have to wonder at what point is government really getting too big. I mean, if you go back and look at what the scripture says about government, the scripture makes it very clear that there's really two purposes for government. Government is obviously ordained by God. It's very clear. Paul talks about this. And other places in the Bible it's mentioned. But one of the things Paul talks about very clearly is that there are two purposes for government. The first is to punish the evildoers. In other words, to keep law and order. The second is to promote the good, you know, to encourage people to do good things. And I think you have to be very careful because it doesn't say for the government to go out and do good things. It says for it to encourage people to go out and do good things. And see, one of the things that as government's grown, it's taken over a lot of the opportunities that the church had to do good work, that families had to do good work, that other social institutions had to do good work, and they've taken it on themselves. I mean, go back to the founding fathers. Everyone was homeschooled in 1776, right? Now, you can argue whether or not that was a good thing or a bad thing, but the literacy rate then was close to what it is now. So I don't know that it was that bad a thing, but what's happened is the government's taken over education. You know, it's in the process, and we'll see where this ends up. It's in the process of taking over healthcare. And all these things only make the government grow larger. And the larger the government gets, the less effective, the less efficient it is at doing the tasks that it's supposed to do. Even though the post office is kind of a quasi-government institution, that's one I point to all the time. If it was a private institution, it would have gone out of business long ago because it goes into the red billions of dollars every year. And you think Federal Express is not going bankrupt. UPS is not going bankrupt. Why can't the post office be run efficiently like these other organizations are? And that's a good question that's never been answered to anybody. So I think, you know, this is a good time for us to reflect on is government really doing what we want it to do?
I think it's such an important point, Hugh, and we'll take a short break. When we come back, I want to keep getting into this a little further because when we look back through the perspective of world history, as governments do get bigger and bigger and bigger, it tends to lead more to a breaking point that often is a violent response as opposed to a cutting back, as you've suggested. So more to come here with Hugh Vulchel on Faith Radio Mornings. Just about 6 minutes before the top of the hour, we're chatting with Hugh Vulchel of the Institute of Faith, Work, and Economics. And Hugh, we just have a couple minutes left here, but such an important point you made before the break, and that's that government tends to get bigger and bigger and bigger. There's not a lot of perspective in world history where the government just sort of decides to shrink itself, and that's true, obviously, in the United States of America. But it has been true throughout all of these different kinds of countries and eras in our world. And one of the things that we see happen, ultimately, is that the government actually ends up breaking apart. People are weary of being controlled by the government. Americans are not the only people who like their freedom, Hugh. That's true of just about anybody around the world throughout history.
That's right. We see it across the pond, so to speak, in Britain. The whole Brexit thing, you know, they got kind of, or felt like they got kind of sucked into this European, you know, this larger European nation or empire, whatever you want to call it. And they got tired of people in Brussels telling them what they could and what they could not do. And so I think you see it all over. And I think will it come to the United States at some point in time? I certainly hope not. But like you said, if history is any indicator, one of the things that concerns me the most, and as we kind of look for breaking points, I think the one that's looming on the horizon that everyone seems to ignore is the incredible debt that being amassed by this country. It's interesting, Ann Bradley, who is our PhD economist at the Institute, she often says that the only thing government can do is destroy wealth. it can't create wealth. It can't, you know, it can print money, but that's not creating wealth. The only thing it can do is take wealth from other people and use it and spend it. It cannot make money. The government cannot make money and doesn't make money. And as a result, our government has gotten in so large and it's gotten into so many different things it probably shouldn't be into, that the debt just continues to increase and everybody seems to completely ignore it. And I think that's going to be the breaking point at some point. You know, there have been points in the last 20, 30 years that the government, and I don't know what the exact numbers are today, but there have been times when the government was borrowing a third of what it spent. Now think about that. How many companies could survive for very long if they went out and borrowed a third every year of what they spent? How many families could survive if they went out and borrowed a third of what they spent every year? Not very many, not for very long. And I think that's the real impending problem that's on the horizon for us. And once again, it's a problem that most politicians tend to completely ignore. They sometimes talk about it when they're running for office, but once they get elected, you don't hear much more about it.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to watch again. We're in uncharted territory, as we suggested, in terms of the rippling implications of this hue. And there are some invitations to rethink some things in the situation as well. Thanks so much for joining us here on Faith Radio Mornings, taking some time as you are a nomad between offices, and look forward to the next time we can chat.
Thank you. God bless you guys.
We'll take a short break here and come back and wrap up our first hour of the show and preview what's coming up here on Hour 2 for Faith Radio Mornings. Always appreciative of such great guests like Drew Griffin of Providence Magazine, as well as Hugh Welchel of the Institute of Faith, Work, and Economics. And speaking of great guests, we can look no further to the man in the green room right now. It is Bill English from BibleandBusiness.com. And Bill and I are going to chat after the top of the hour break here about some different dimensions of Ecclesiastes 5 and what we can learn from that passage of Scripture relative to our finances.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.